uncovers corporate lies, exposes political corruption, and has a clear vision of what America could become. Here's Tom Hartman.
And greetings, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth, and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. Tom Hartman here with you, broadcasting live coast to coast, border to border on the Sirius satellite radio system, on radio stations from California to North Carolina, beaming down from outer space. Well, I already said that, didn't I? And on radiopower.org, whiterosesociety.org, American FM on live365.com. Welcome to our program. And on the digital system, CRN Digital, on cable TV systems in 29 states, CRN Digital. And pleased to be on there. In fact, we had a caller yesterday just calling up and thanking us for CRN Digital. So it's great. More than 150 newspapers and several local and local TV and radio stations sprang up immediately after the fall of Saddam Hussein in Iraq. This was heralded as one of the biggest successes of the U.S.-led invasion. This was the story. Everybody was talking about it. And I would suspect this got so much hype and so much press. I would suspect that if you were to go around and ask the average American, you know, what's going on with the press in Iraq, they would say, oh, there's all kinds of newspapers and there's all kinds of radio stations and TV stations, and they have a free press. Freedom's on the march. Yes, indeed. Don't worry. Everything's just great. Unfortunately, it ain't so. It ain't so. Al Jazeera, for example, the network based out of Qatar, has been banned from Iraq. Banned. And many of the newspapers have been shut down. The Center for American Progress reports in recent months, well, they're citing a Knight Ritter report, so here we go. Knight Ritter reports Iraqi police have, quote, begun cracking down on local journalists, creating a wave of fear reminiscent of Saddam's era, end quote. Reporters Without Borders, this is one of those, sort of like Doctors Without Borders, this is an international group, a watchdog group that keeps track of the Iraqi, or of not just Iraqi, of press freedom around the world, not just Iraqi press freedom, track the arrests of five Iraqi journalists within a two-week period, and issued a statement on April 26th asking authorities, quote, to be more discerning and restrained and not carry out hasty and arbitrary arrests. Please, please don't arrest us. The cases include a photographer for a Baghdad newspaper who says Iraqi police beat and detained him for snapping pictures of long lines at gas stations. Oh, that's a crime. Now, keep in mind this at the same time that here in the United States, if you get caught taking a picture of a bridge or a nuclear power plant or a big office building, you can be dragged off. And many people have. Nonetheless, the cases include a photographer for a Baghdad newspaper who says Iraqi police beat and detained him for snapping pictures of long lines at gas stations, a reporter for another local paper who received death threats from police recruits, and a local TV reporter who says she's lost count of how many times Iraqi authorities have confiscated her cameras and smashed her tapes. Freedom is on the march! Yeah. Diesel Creek in the chat room. You can get to our live chat room by going to TomHartman.com and clicking on live chat. Diesel Creek says, Tom, the problem is Abu Ghraib. He says, Abu Ghraib and the like. They are turning out insurgents faster than the military can kill them. Yeah. Absolutely. And no country likes to be occupied. I mean, period. It's a truism. No country likes to be occupied. We'd like our own police, thank you very much, our own military, our own systems. No country wants to be occupied. You can't get around it. Plus, countries tend to get upset when you occupy them and then pump their oil as hard and as fast as you can. When you spend more time and attention protecting their oil facilities than you do making sure that the citizens are getting electricity, when the oil ministry is working fine and the hospitals aren't, when employment in the oil sector is at 110% and unemployment among the population at large is 50%, people tend to get a little concerned. People tend not to like that sort of thing. Pat Robertson in the news again today. Of course, you know, the media hog. He's out there with George Stephanopoulos this weekend saying essentially that God doesn't interfere in the events of things. You know, Stephanopoulos asked him, how could, you know, if God is so active in the world here, why did he let this tsunami happen? And Robertson says, well, you know, he doesn't interfere in plate tectonics. But he may interfere in human events. So, for example, this, you know, Pat Robertson and Jerry Falwell. It starts out with Jerry Falwell here on the 700 Club.
What we saw on Tuesday, as terrible as it is.
He's talking about 9/11.
Could be minuscule if, in fact, God continues to lift the curtain and allow the enemies of America to give us probably what we deserve.
Well, Jerry, that's my feeling. I think we've just seen the antechamber to terror. We haven't even begun to see what they can do to the major population.
Did I just hear a couple of terrorists talking? Did I just hear somebody say, this is only the antechamber? This is like the small room you go through to get to the large room. This is only the beginning. Did I just hear Jerry Falwell saying we got what we deserved? Why is this not played every time one of these bloviators gets on national television?
The enemies of America to give us probably what we deserve.
Well, Jerry, that's my feeling. I think we've just seen the antechamber to terror. We haven't even begun to see what they can do to the major population.
Wow. Wow. Here again, Falwell and Robertson.
That I really believe that the pagans and the abortionists and the feminists and the gays and the lesbians who are actively trying to make that an alternative lifestyle, the ACLU, People for the American Way, all of them who tried to secularize America.
They're responsible for 9/11.
I point the thing in their face and say, you helped this happen.
Well, I totally concur, and the problem is we have adopted that agenda at the highest levels of our government, and so we're responsible as a free society for what the top people do, and the top people, of course, the court system.
So it was the judges who are responsible for 9/11. Now this, keep in mind, was 3 days after 9/11 that this conversation was going on between Falwell and Roberts. 3 days after 9/11... You've got Jerry Falwell and Pat Roberts saying we got what we deserved on 9/11, that God allowed it to happen because of homosexuality in the United States, that there's more and worse to come because that's what their God would have happen. I'm sorry, I am a Christian, and I do not recognize my God in their God. I just don't. I'm sorry. And here they are saying that we got what we deserved and that there's more to come. And that why? Because it's all the fault of the judges. All the fault of the judges. And now the judges are back around again in the news. Pat Robertson today, it's getting a lot of press, and yesterday it got a lot of press because on Sunday on Stephanopoulos' program, he's talking about this, you know, he's saying, well, you know, these judges, they're a greater threat to America than the Nazis were, a greater threat to America than the Japanese were. This is a greater crisis for America than the Civil War was. What is this crisis? What is this threat? Justice Kennedy on the court. A Republican. A moderate Republican, but a Republican. Sandra Day O'Connor. These guys saying, oh, well, you know, these judges who get killed, their families killed, they're just getting what they deserve, these guys are saying. I mean, give me a break, guys. Congress, meanwhile, in the real world, where there's some real concerns about what's really going on, Congressman John Conyers of Michigan is raising the real issue. It's all over the British press. Oh, you hadn't heard it? Well, you know, listen to BBC. Oh, maybe you can't get BBC. This is the screaming issue in England. Why is it not even being mentioned in the corporate-owned mainstream press of the United States? Why is it not even being mentioned that Tony Blair has been outed by a member of his own administration as in 2002... before the U.S. midterm elections, when George W. Bush was still running around saying, I don't know why you're saying we're going to go to war. I get to make the decisions, not you. When George W. Bush is saying, no, we may go to war, we may not, we don't know. At that time, when we had no idea that George W. had already decided to go into Iraq, he was denying it. He was lying to us. We had no idea that Karl Rove had gone down to Texas and said, hey, here's the plan to win back the presidency, or to win the presidency for the first time. Because he was selected the first time, not elected. Here's the plan. We're going to make you the war president. Bob Woodward gave us a little glimpse into it, but now it's all been laid out. The London Times, which I believe Rupert Murdoch owns, reports that the British government and the United States government had secretly agreed to attack Iraq in 2000 before authorization was sought for such an attack in Congress, and had discussed creating pretextual justifications for doing so. They had already decided to attack Iraq, and they were trying to come up with the rationalizations. The Times reports, based on a newly discovered document, that in 2002, British Prime Minister Tony Blair chaired a meeting in which he expressed his support for regime change through the use of force in Iraq and was warned by the nation's top lawyer that such an action would be illegal. He adds, Blair also discussed the need for America to create conditions to justify the war. Tony Blair, talking within his cabinet to his trusted principal advisors, saying, George W. and I have already decided we're going to go to war. The United States Congress has not voted to authorize it. The United Nations has not voted to authorize it. We're going to do it anyway. And we have to come up with a strategy to sell it. It's the same thing they're doing with the Supreme Court justices now. You've got Priscilla Owen and Janice Rogers Brown, whose main sin is not that they are women or that Janice Rogers Brown is black, as the cons would have you think. No, their main sin is that Priscilla Owen is of the opinion that 1937, that Social Security was the socialist revolution in America. And Janice Rogers Brown consistently voted in favor of corporations and against human beings. In fact, both of them did. This is what's really going on. These two are corporatists. They're in the pockets of the big multinational corporations, pure and simple, beginning and end. That's what it's all about. That's why the Democrats are fighting them. And the cons are going, oh, no, they're people of faith. Oh, no, they're women. They smile nice on TV. Somebody once said a good thing about him, and he was a Democrat. Let's talk about it. Give me a break, guys. Hustling a war, hustling judges. How many times do we have to get lied to? 20 minutes past the hour.
Fearlessly exploring the truth of the day, here's Tom Hartman.
Cool, cool, glad you made it. Welcome to the world of entertainment. It's unlike any other game around.
Yes, the world of entertainment. Now we see Laura Bush being trotted out to try and burnish the image of her husband, whose poll ratings are in the tank. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. 1-866-889-8894. Telephone number. Joe in New Jersey is with us. Hey, Joe, what's up?
Hey, Tom. Great show.
Thank you. Oh, hey, by the way, I want to let you know, at the bottom of the hour, we're going to have Scott Ritter on and have a conversation with him about what's going on in the world.
Oh, excellent. Great. Hey, I think I've heard you talk about this before, mandatory voting. And I really believe that's what this country needs, because we can talk about these religious nuts as much as we want, but basically, they're getting the votes out now. They're getting their battalions of...
But you know how it works in Australia? In Australia, if you don't vote, they add $25 to your taxes.
Exactly. That's the way it should be here. I mean,
it's kind of like a traffic ticket, you know?
Yeah. Example would be Israel, what has happened there. You have religious Orthodox people who have basically taken over that government, and I think that's a roadmap to what's happening here in this country, too. we can talk about the issues, and we have most of the population on our side, but the problem is not everyone turns out to vote, but religious people do turn out to vote because of a fear thing, and they're being led down the path with some of these fundamentalist preachers.
Yeah.
So,
In my opinion, the way that we should handle this is that rather than making it mandatory so that you're breaking a law if you fail to vote, we should provide people with some sort of an incentive to vote. And although, frankly, before we get to that, I mean, such as, you know, yes, I voted, I can check $25 off of my taxes. But the problem is, how do you verify that? How do you keep track of that? And then you have a situation where if the government is verifying that you voted, might they be able to equally, particularly in this age of computerization, verify for whom you voted? And then you might end up like these guys who wanted to go to this trade conference, Nokia, you know, the cell phone manufacturer. There was a conference down in South America on international telecom standards, and they were going to send a bunch of their employees to this thing, and the Bush administration refused to allow several of them to go because they had contributed money to the John Kerry campaign. So, you know, once the government has the ability to know not only that you voted, but for whom you voted, then you're really moving into a Stalinist state. So, frankly, I think that the way to do it is to change the way that we vote so that it's no longer on a Tuesday. It's on a Saturday and a Sunday. We do it over 2 days, over the whole weekend. And that gives people who have a religious objection to doing things on Saturday or on Sunday, Orthodox Jews, Orthodox Christians, or, you know, observant Christians, that gives them an opportunity to do it on the opposite day. It's days that traditionally people don't work. It's going to be much less of a burden on people. Make it a national holiday, although if it was on a weekend, you know, you'd have the same effect, basically. But, you know, make it a national hoop-de-doop. And we need to do what England has done, and that is put limits on the amount of money that politicians can spend on advertising, and make it illegal to have any television or radio advertising for candidates, but instead require the radio and television stations to carry promotions for those candidates. Now, that's something that I know is not going to fly. You know, it's not going to make happy the radio and television stations of this country and the networks and whatnot, because they made over $4 billion in the last election, or almost $4 billion. The total that was spent was $4 billion, most of it on radio and television. And, you know, they just don't want to see that happen. But anyhow, Joe, I appreciate the call. Thanks a lot. 1-866-889-8894, our telephone number. Frank in Connecticut on the line. Hey, Frank, what's up?
Hey, Tom, how are you?
I'm great. We've only got about a half a minute, Frank, and then we got to go to Scott.
Okay, I'll make it real short. I called a couple weeks ago. I identify myself as a neoconservative. You abruptly said to me, you know, what are your intentions? Are you like Ann Coulter that want to go into countries, turn them into Christians, or kill them? And then you hung up by saying, I spent 15 minutes with you. That's way too much time. I take the call. I was on for 4 minutes, 22 seconds. You talked for 4 minutes and 3 seconds. Here's
complaint about your call was that all you were doing was calling names.
No, I wasn't calling names.
Yeah, Carter's the worst president ever. You don't have, you know, blah de blah de blah. You weren't talking specifics.
Okay, let me talk specifics.
Okay, Joe, I'm going to have to, we really are up against a hard break. The music is going to start any second now, and then, as I said, I've got Scott Ritter. In fact, there's the music, and I'm not just pushing this in. Joe, I would love to have a conversation with you. Call back in the next hour. I'll talk to you as long as you want. 29 minutes past the hour. It's the Tom Hartman Radio Program.
Democracy to the United States of America. Here's Tom Hartman.
Lock up your husband. Lock up your son.
Yeah, look out. George is coming. He's going to milk a horse. not my joke, Laura Bush's. By the way, one of the problems with booking guests who are also volunteer firemen is that people have fires. Scott Ritter's off fighting a fire. So he's not going to be with us in this segment. He may be with us later on in the program. Louise is going to continue to try and contact him, but he said that if he wasn't around, it meant he was out fighting a fire, and apparently that is where he is. And so we will have him on, eventually. And in the meantime, I think it was Joe, our neocon caller. You want to call back and we can have it out on the air, right here, right now, 866-889-8894. In the meantime, Andy Borowitz, the Borowitz Report. Just 2 days after her comedy appearance at Saturday night's White House Correspondents' Annual Dinner was hailed by the national media as a triumph, and overconfident Laura Bush bombed in her second comedy outing using a Rose Garden ceremony to try out some new material that leaned heavily on tasteless Yo Mama jokes. Trouble began at the outset of the ceremony, a presentation of an award to former British Prime Minister Margaret Thatcher, when the First Lady impishly warned the press contingent, "I hope you don't mind if I go a little blue today." What followed, one observer said, was a torrent of Yo Mama jokes, rife with language and imagery that would peel paint. While most of the First Lady's ribald jests were unfit for publication in a family newspaper, one of her tamer quips went like this. Yo Mama's so hairy her armpits look like she has Don King in a headlock. In an attempt at damage control, the White House later released an official statement saying that reassuring the American people that Mrs. Bush would not quit her day job. Yeah. It's Andy Borowitz, theborowitzreport.com. Congressman John Conyers is circulating a letter. Got it. Congressman John Conyers is circulating a letter calling for a further inquiry into a secret U.S. agreement to attack Iraq. Oh, I mentioned that at the top of the hour, didn't I? I started out with that. I believe. Sometimes I get lost here. 1-866-889-8894, our telephone number. Joe, our neocon friend, is back on the line. Hey, Joe.
All right. I think appreciate this. Well, you know, let me start by saying that often when a caller from the right or left comes in and say they made a conversion to the other side, they're automatically doubted. I don't think I've made a conversion. I consider myself independent. Let me tell you what I agree with the Democrats on. Virtually everything. I think their approach to the environment is right. I think they're right on the major issues of my lifetime, from civil rights to the Vietnam War to the environment to social issues and even the economy, which the Republicans, you know, I have claimed to be the friend of the businessman. I seem to do better personally under Democratic leadership.
Well, if you look back over the last 110 years, Joe, you will discover that every time that there is a president in the White House who is a Republican, the stock market goes down and the net worth of the country diminishes. And every time there's a Democrat, the stock market goes up. Real simple.
Right. So I feel that, you know, I'm the guy that got George Bush elected. And what I mean by that is I think there's a lot of people call us Reagan Democrats or Rust Belt Democrats that made the switch to the other side for one single issue, and that is national security. Now, let me just tell you my experience of flipping on the dial, because I'm new to the satellite thing. In listening to the right-wing, some of the right-wing stations, I am hearing a whole bunch of the anti-Clinton stuff. And when I hear that, and this is my advice to them. When I hear all the Clinton hatred, it reminds me why I despise them all these years. But let me do the flip side. In two calls I made to left-wing radio show hosts, let me tell you the response I had last week. One, that's again on your station, said to me that she believed that there was a equal likelihood that Dick Cheney was responsible for 9/11 as Osama bin Laden. She said, quote unquote, it's a flip of the coin. Some days I think it was Osama. Some days I think that it was Dick Cheney.
What do you think about Pat Robertson's theory that it's God and the judges?
He's absurd. And as long as there's individuals like that that represent even an element of the Republican Party, I can never change I can never become a Republican. Because I hear comments like that. Now, another talk show host, and again, I know that you are not responsible for your callers, but I am really concerned, and this is why I fear or feel that satellite radio becoming increasingly popular could be a factor in deciding potential elections. Another one on the left said, another talk show host said that he believes that Christian fundamentalism is just as evil and just as dangerous as Islamic fundamentalism. This is why I feel that you're losing me. And, you know, not to use that
Joe,
old...
Joe, have you ever heard of Tim McVeigh?
Sure.
You know why he blew up the federal building in Oklahoma City?
Well, primarily because of Waco, or, you know, so he claims. And
no, that's not what he claimed.
Or was it, you know, just his anti... He was a right-wing. He was a right-wing
He blew up the building in Waco because he felt that that was what it would take to energize white, conservative Christians in the United States to rise up against what he perceived to be an anti-Christian administration that was allowing babies to be murdered in the context of abortion and that was allowing pornography to be promoted and on the internet and on television and whatnot. He was a Christian fundamentalist, and that's why he blew up the building in Waco, the second worst terrorist incident in the history of the United States. You can read it in his own words. He read the Turner Diaries. There's a whole bunch of folks like him.
Oh,
in
absolutely.
Fact, they just found a guy down in Texas with enough explosives to blow up a small town. A right-wing conservative Christian terrorist got very little publicity. If the guy had been a Muslim, it would have been all over the headlines. It would have been the wall. It would have blown Michael Jackson out of the news cycle.
No, I understand. But I guess here's where I'm fundamentally coming from. And I feel like I'm the kid that, you know, 6-7 years old, wants to believe in Santa Claus, but the kids on the bus are saying it's not real. I want to come back to the fold because I firmly, in my heart of hearts, I'm a grateful, dead, diehard liberal in my heart. But here's what I think it really comes down to as far as I'm concerned. I believe that the right, or the Republicans, believe fundamentally that the United States is a force of good in the world, and I think that.
Well, let me just stop you right there for a minute, Joe.
Yep.
If you really believe that the Republicans think that, then why are we sending our citizens? Why are we sending not just our citizens? Why are we sending people to nations that boil people to death, that do electroshock therapy, as it were, that pull out fingernails and toenails with pliers as a form of interrogation, that previous governments and this current administration, this current State Department, last year said Uzbekistan does this to their prisoners, and therefore George W. Bush invites the president of Uzbekistan over to the White House, showers him with gifts, gives him $500 million in cash, and then we start sending him prisoners for interrogation. If you really think that George Bush thinks he's a force for good, why are we getting in bed with these terrorists? Why is he holding hands with and kissing Prince Abdullah, who is the head of Saudi Arabia, the nation that is probably the most repressive theocracy in the entire world right now? Yes, there are worse governments, but they're secular. Kim Jong-il.
Can I tell you? I agree with you. I absolutely agree with you. I do believe there is a larger issue.
These Republicans don't think that they're a force for good in the world. That's the rhetoric that they're using to fool people like you. They're in it for the money.
You really believe that?
I really do.
You do?
Because I'm looking at what they're doing. I'm not listening to what they're saying.
Yeah. Let me ask you this. Do you believe that there is a likelihood that Islamic terrorists will detonate some sort of nuclear device in the United States within the next 5 years or so? If you have to throw a statistical number on that.
I really don't know. Although I think, I'll acknowledge that it's possible, I think it's also possible that conservative Christian fundamentalists could detonate a nuclear weapon in the United States. We don't know who the anthrax killer is yet. It may well be another Christian terrorist like Tim McVeigh. I'm opposed to all terrorists, Joe. And I'll tell you, when you deal with terrorism, and there are nations that have a long history of dealing with terrorism and doing it successfully. The way that Italy dealt with the Red Brigades, the way that Germany dealt with the Bader-Meinhof gang. I lived in Germany when they were dealing with the Bader-Meinhof gang, and I watched it right up front. The way that England dealt with the IRA, the way that Spain has dealt with the Basque separatists, the ETA, ETA, the way that Greece dealt with November 17. All of these were terrorist groups. In Italy, the Red Brigades even hijacked the president, the prime minister he was. They kidnapped him, put him in the trunk of a car where he died. They killed the prime minister. The country did not declare war. The country did not elevate these people to iconic status. None of these nations said, oh, look at these people, they're so terrible. It's like they didn't turn them into Lex Luthor. They didn't turn them into the juggler or the Joker. They didn't turn them into superheroes like George W. Bush did with Osama bin Laden, because they didn't feel the need for them to be superheroes. What they did was what Bush should have done, which is what Clinton did with Tim McVeigh. And what Bush should have done with Osama bin Laden, they said, these people are nuts. They're sick. They're criminals. They are the scum of the earth. We need to collectively get together the police forces of our nation, hunt them down, find them, put them in jail, punish them, make sure that they can never do this to us again, end of discussion. But no, George Bush instead said, oh, this guy is a superhero. I can be a superhero too. And the only way, Bush was tanking in the polls so badly after having stolen an election, and everybody knew it, that the only way he figured that he could get back his status was to have a war. We had to have a war. And that's why when Afghanistan said, we will give you Osama bin Laden, you can have him. You can come in and shut down al-Qaeda. There were only 20,000 al-Qaeda in the whole world then, and most of them were in Afghanistan. We could have closed the whole thing. And Bush said, no, that's not what he wanted. What he wanted was something spectacular. I'm telling you, Joe, these guys are in it for the money and the power.
So you obviously didn't support our invasion of Afghanistan.
We didn't need to. We didn't need to.
Did you support what Clinton did in Kosovo?
I have to tell you that at the time that happened, I was doing an enormous amount of international travel. I was running a business, and I frankly wasn't paying all that much attention. So I can't intelligently speak about the situation in Kosovo.
Mm-hmm. Well, anyway, I appreciate your honesty, and I appreciate what I consider a good conversation.
Okay, thanks, Joe. I appreciate
the
call.
You.
Thanks.
Bye bye.
1-866-889-8894, our telephone number. What can I say? Vitamin C in high doses, this is a little bit of a digression, but every now and then I come across these things, and I think they're important enough that it's worth sharing with people. Remember Linus Pauling was talking about vitamin C, you know, vitamin C will prevent cancer, vitamin C will prevent old age, and he took like 20, 30 grams of vitamin C every day. That's 20 or 30,000 milligrams. You know those great big horse pills, that's one gram, 1,000 milligrams, or the average pills are 500 milligrams, half of a horse pill. He was taking 20, 30, 40 of these things a day throughout his life, and he lived until he was in his, as I recall, late 80s when Linus Pauling finally died, sharp as a tack, right up to the end there. Vitamins can help limit the damage smokers do to their bodies. Somebody ought to tell Laura Bush about this. You can see that her heavy smoking now is starting to take a toll. It's starting, you know, the creases in her lips and things, these are the characteristics. She's starting to get smoker's face. And vitamin C will actually diminish the damage done by smoking. Not that you should continue smoking. I mean, the obvious and easiest way to stop the damage from smoking is to quit smoking. But this was a study that they did on pregnant women. 12% of American women who are pregnant smoke. And so they did a study on pregnant women where they gave some of them vitamin C and some of them not. And then they looked at their babies. And what they found was that the babies of the women who took vitamin C while they were smoking while they were pregnant didn't have the lung damage that the babies, and you think he's in the womb, how can he breathe? You know, but the lungs are all made out of this kind of connective tissue, lots and lots of collagen in there, and that's what vitamin C helps build. And the lungs of the babies who were the mothers of the smokers who didn't take vitamin C were not as functional. And in both cases, the babies were underweight, but the vitamin C made a big difference. So, you know, it didn't solve the problem of the damage that was done by the smoking, but it made a big difference. So that's step one. In this recovery, I want to talk about economics a little bit, and we'll get into this a little more in the next hour. The area of the low minimum card payment, credit card payment, it may be coming to an end. And the reason why, in my opinion, is that the credit card companies and the federal government, the regulators of the credit card companies, see that the insane economic policies of the Bush administration are about to catch up with us. They're coming down the road. They are coming to get us. This from the DelawareOnline.com. The era of the diminutive minimum credit card payment is coming to an end. Major U.S. credit card issuers are raising the minimum amount cardholders must pay each month. It's going up from 2% to 4%. Now, the good news on that is that if you had, for example, a $10,000 balance at 8%, at 18%, excuse me, which is not uncommon, the average credit card balance in the United States among people who have a balance in their credit card, the average is $7,000. That's how in debt the middle class is. And your average credit card interest rates run around 16 to 18%. So if you had a $10,000 balance at 18%, your minimum payment right now is $200. It's going to go up to $400. That's the bad news. The good news is that if you just pay the $200 a month, it's going to take you 58 years to pay off your credit card. Most of us will be well into retirement by that time, if even still around. That's if you just pay the minimum 2%, whereas at the 4% rate, you'll pay it off in only 15 years. Also, at the 2% rate, you'd pay $28,930 in interest on a $10,000 balance. You would triple the balance. You owe $10,000, you pay $38,000 to clear it up. $28,900 in interest and $10,000 on the balance. Whereas if you pay it off in 15 years, you only pay $15,915, $10,000 for the principal, $5,915 for the balance. This is the same principle of if you have a mortgage on a house, just double your payments. Or just add an extra $100 to the payments every month. And surprise, surprise, your house will get paid off very quickly, and the interest of the bank drops dramatically. Now, some banks have figured out ways to weasel out of this, so you have to be sure to say, apply this to the principal. Not, this is not an advance interest payment, which is, you know, the scam the banks are up to these days. Anyhow, it's 10 minutes before the hour. I'm Tom Hartman here with you. Talk radio for the rest of us. We shall return in just a moment.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Absolutely nothing. Welcome back, my friends. Well, you know, there are times, as Ecclesiastes says, there's a time for war and a time for peace. This just ain't the time for war. I would have supported World War II in a heartbeat, but this ain't the time for war. John in New York is on the line. Hey, John, welcome to the program.
Hi, good afternoon, Tom.
What's up?
I would like to just say that the last call, I'd like to welcome to the Sirius family. What he really found is the truth. No matter what station he flips to, right or left, you're going to find out his president. And I stress his president is a scuzzball.
Yeah.
All right.
Well said. Thanks a lot, John. I appreciate it. 1-866-889-8894, our telephone number. John in Butte, Montana on the line. Hey, John, welcome to the program.
Oh, it's Mark, but whatever.
Oh, Mark, I'm sorry. I'm looking at the wrong name on the screen here. Hey, Mark.
That'll happen. Hey, I wanted to comment on the bank or the credit cards, and that led me to think about the bankruptcy bill, and I get all kinds of wound up over that.
Oh yeah, this is the what you're seeing here with these cons in Congress, both the Republicans and the Democrats who vote with them, is the sellout of America's middle class to the corporate elite and to the millionaires and billionaires among us, to the 7,000 families in America who earn more than $10 million a year. That it's an absolute sellout to them because they're the ones who pay for political campaigns. That's why we should do what England does and say you can't spend more than $100,000 on a political campaign, period. And the media cannot accept advertising for political campaigns. They have to share debates.
That seems reasonable. Now,
it works in England.
The thing that gets me about it is there's absolutely no accountability for the credit card companies. I get four or five credit cards a week. You know, they send them to dogs and kids, and
yeah,
and they hold us responsible for our bad decisions. But
right.
When they send, I have a friend who's over $100,000 in debt, credit card debt, hasn't had a job in 6 years, but they keep sending him cards. Whose fault is that?
That's incredible. $100,000. That's unpayable. I mean, at 18%, that's going to double every couple. What is that? Every 5 years, I think, at 18%, the amount will double. Maybe every 4 years.
It's certainly
that's
unpayable.
Incredible.
They haven't worked in 6 years.
That's incredible.
You know, but
that's tragic.
And then the Democrats. I heard this on the Ed Schultz show that they wanted to install a 30% interest cap.
Yeah.
Into that bill.
Yeah, on the bankruptcy bill. It was Chuck Schumer of New York proposed that, and 100% of the Republicans voted against it. 100% of them. Mark, I gotta wrap it up here. It is an abomination. I agree. I appreciate your call. I totally agree with you. Wages fall 0.7% after adjustment for inflation. Corporate profits up 11.7%. And guess who's in the White House? Guess who's in Congress? Guess who's controlling the federal government? That's right, folks, the corporatists. It's not just the Republicans, it's the corporatists. There's a few Democrats in there with them as well. We need to get them all out and get some real statesmen in there for a change. I'm Tom Hartman.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information. Calling for for a rapid and radical return to the old values that made America great, the values of democracy on which this country was founded? Here's Tom Hartman.
And welcome back, my friends. 7 minutes past the hour. Amid rising nuclear tensions, more than 180 nations convened Monday to review the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty, reports the Associated Press, hearing calls from many sides for concessions by Iran and North Korea. Those nasty folks, the United States, Russia, and others. Now, let me read this right here now. Hearing calls from many sides for concessions by Iran and North Korea, the United States, Russia, and others to move toward a world free of the nuclear threat. So, really, the way it should read, they had an and in the wrong place there, is that folks are asking for us, as well as Russia, as well as North Korea, as well as Iran, to all not get into more nuclear warheads. And, in fact, we had agreed, as part of the original Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty, the NNT, or the NPT, depending on who's you're using, that we would reduce the number of warheads that we have. The Soviet Union, Russia, had said that they would reduce the number of weapons they had in exchange for that. The other countries of the world, the non-nuclear nations of the world, said that they would not develop nuclear weapons. Doesn't quite seem to be working out as planned. Ann Miller just returned from a 10-day trip to Iran. She's the director of the New Hampshire Peace Action Group. And thought we'd get her on here, see what her thoughts are on this. And welcome to the Tom Hartman program.
Oh, thank you so much, Tom.
And if anybody has a call or question for Ann, our number 1-866-889-8894. Ann, tell us about, you say if we are serious about curbing proliferation in Iran, we need a new strategy. What is that new strategy?
I think, well, first of all, we need to stop with the rhetoric that the Bush administration has been sending to Iran, specifically with regard to Iran being an axis of evil, and how that plays out in the American in media and in the minds of Americans. Iran is no axis of evil. At this point, talking to folks within the country, people are concerned about their security with respect to the U.S. and to Israel, and certainly the government is. And any weapons that are currently in production, from everything I gathered in talking with people and have read, it would be a deterrent strategy. It would not be for preemptive purposes, as this administration or Bush administration is suggesting.
So they're saying, we just want to have something. I mean, this is basically Kim Jong-il's thing, right? That he wasn't building nuclear weapons until George W. Bush started calling him a axis of evil guy, and John Bolton started calling him a pipsqueak and a pimp and all these other names that Bolton was calling him. And basically the Iranians are saying the same thing. You know, we don't need a nuclear weapon unless we feel threatened. It's not that we want it because we want to take out somebody else.
Precisely.
Isn't that true of every country, though?
Hmm.
I mean, look at the USSR. During the Cold War, the USSR internally was demagoguing the danger of America. They were constantly freaking out their people with how America was going to attack them at any minute. Here in the United States, from Joe McCarthy through Richard Nixon, there was constant demagoguery about how the Soviet Union was going to take us out any day. And both sides were using that as an excuse to build more and more nuclear weapons, when I don't think either side had even the remotest intention of using these things in an offensive way.
Yep. Well, I agree that that's true, but I would say that today it's not. The Bush administration is now trying to push through some monies to help fund the bunker buster.
Right.
And I would say that for the first time, especially since the Nuclear Posture Review of 2002, the Bush administration and the U.S. is now looking at possible preemptive uses for nuclear weapons, the bunker buster being one of them, sort of some of these other advanced concept weapons, including the mini nukes being others. So I would say the U.S. is the sole country that is currently looking at a foreign policy that involves possible preemptive nuclear strikes on nuclear and or non-nuclear countries.
This is the first time in world history, is it not?
I would say yes, and I mean we've had nuclear weapons for the last 60 years, and this is the first time that it's been stated policy.
It's a little mind-boggling. I mean that you were going to say, however.
Right. However, I was thinking about Carter's directive. He did say that we would be securing our interest, the U.S. interest in the Middle East at any cost, which you could extrapolate from that that a possible preemptive nuclear strike might be a part of that.
Yeah, but, although at the same time Carter was saying that, in 77, he gave the speech in which he said we have to become energy independent of the Middle East. We have to get out of the Middle East. We can't be dependent upon. I mean, it was a long speech, an extraordinary speech. And then in 79, he gave a speech. And in the 77 speech, he started the National Petroleum Stockpile. He launched the birthed the solar industry, many would say. And in 79, he made a speech in which he said that he wanted by the year 2000, 20% of our energy to be coming from solar.
God, doesn't this make you long for those days?
Well, I think Jimmy Carter was really the last great president we had.
I really truly
believe that. And he's so easily dissed because the cons have done such a great job of rewriting history. But when you go back and look at what he did during his administration, I mean, certainly he inherited a terrible economic problem that was a consequence of the Vietnam War being funded by debt, and the conservative economic policies of Richard Nixon. But, you know, setting that aside, I mean, the guy really, he was a good man who did, he was the last great American president.
Yep. He was talking about oil consumption and peak oil even back in the late 70s. Before
and peace talking. And integrity and human rights and the United States being not feared but respected. I don't think George W. Bush has, and I you probably don't want to get dragged into the politics of this, but in my opinion, George W. Bush does not have the life experience to even have an understanding of the notion of being respected rather than being feared. I think all his life he's been the rich guy that people either tried to suck up to because they wanted something from him or they were afraid of because he could harm them, he could punish them.
Mm-hmm.
And that has become our national policy. There's no element of respect in our national policy. It's all fear.
Yeah, I'd like to speak to that a little bit with respect to my trip to Iran. It was really interesting going just, and this is just sort of a straw poll of folks who I know in my own family and people being so concerned about my going there and isn't Iran unsafe and we'll pray for you. I mean, I even had people say that and I don't come from a particularly religious community.
Right.
And it was interesting the enormous disconnect between concerns and anxieties before the trip and what I actually found when I was there.
What was it like?
I have never met a people more lovely than the Iranian people. So beautiful, so open, so incredibly welcoming, and they love America. And that was actually a little disconcerting at first. But there are folks who, one of their first questions is, "Do you have a Yahoo email account? And let's go ahead and switch, you know, exchange emails so we can stay in touch." They want to be talking on cell phones. They so desperately want to be connected to the Western world and to the U.S. and enjoy the civil liberties that we still enjoy relative to the current regime in Iran, certainly.
Right.
And they love us. And it's just so interesting. Again, this axis of evil rhetoric and other rhetoric coming out of the White House, because it is so incredibly far from the truth. I mean,
least with regard to the people. I mean,
the people.
There have been, I think it was Pew who did a poll there. Maybe it was Zogby. It was one of the large national pollsters did a poll in Iran just about 8 or 9 months ago. It was in the middle of last year. And found that something like more than 80% of average Iranians considered themselves pro-American,
mm-hmm.
and viewed America as a role model. Even post-Bush, they were viewing America in a positive way.
Yeah.
Although they had concerns about George W. Bush, he didn't do so well in their national polls. But they loved America. But you do, and the government of Iran has been moving or been trying to move in very progressive and positive and democratic directions. However, their constitution allows the mullahs to essentially act like the Supreme Court does here and veto legislation. And as a consequence of that, the mullahs, the religious fanatics on the right in Iran, hold the ultimate power. And that may actually legitimately throw them into, I wouldn't call it the axis of evil, but certainly into the category of a country that's not the way that we want to be or that we want to support.
Sure. I mean, one thing about Khomeini, and you're absolutely right about that, he has veto power over their parliament, their majlis. In fact, I think he vetoed something like 90% of the reforms that the current president, Khatami, tried to get through in the last year. So he certainly plays a huge role. But I would also say that Khomeini is very much interested in trying to figure out the politics and get a hold on his own country. He's it's my understanding that he doesn't have any interest in ruling the rest of the world. It's his own country that he's concerned about, and there's so much domestic strife right now. We've got a population there, 70% is under the age of 30, and they are really pushing at the Islamic State to make some reforms. And it's interesting to see and read about the debates that are happening within the mullahs to figure out how to best do that. For instance, internet, several folks have been arrested for blogging. There are certainly many political dissidents who are in prison with respect to internet, what the regime considers to be internet violations. However, they have an internet. They have access to Google. They have access to online resources and connection to the rest of the world in a way that, say, Iraq never had. And I think it's my understanding that this regime is really trying to get to the people by some kind of economic reform. They do have a functional economy. Their GDP is 22nd in the world. It's ahead of Poland. But it's not thriving. It's certainly not a thriving economy at this point.
Well, and it's largely based on the export of oil.
Yes. Yes, and several other things, like pistachios is also enormous as well, surprisingly enough.
Yeah.
Yep.
But I mean, oil is a big chunk of that.
Yep, absolutely.
So the bottom line here, we have about 2.5 minutes, Ann. We're talking with Ann Miller of New Hampshire Peace Action.
Yes.
New Hampshire Peace Action. And what policy should the United States be following, and what policy or posture should average Americans be taking with regard to Iran and with regard to our attempting to influence our elected officials in their interactions with Iran?
Yeah, great question. Some folks I spoke with at an NGO, it's a conservation NGO in Tehran, said a couple of things. One is that we need more Americans visiting Iran and just doing people-to-people cultural exchanges and getting to know one another. Currently, only about 500 Americans who do not have family in Iran visit every year, and that's a really low number if we're trying to sort of cross-pollinate and build people-to-people.
So we need to increase tourism. But like with Cuba, the administration makes it very difficult for you to be a tourist in Iran, do they not? Our administration.
No, there are no restrictions.
Oh, really?
To the U.S. The issue does come with the Iranian government.
Ah, the mullahs again.
And getting a visa to get in.
Yeah.
And again, I went with a Code Pink, which is a women's peace group, and part of Global Exchange, which is a human rights group, and Peace Action, which is another activist group. So some of us did have some trouble getting visas, but for Americans who want to certainly just enjoy a culture that's very different and very interesting and so historically deep and rich, I can't stress enough.
Yeah,
the need to go.
It sounds like a good and important step. And then suggest to the United States that rather than being belligerent, we should, you know, not to sound too sappy or too Rodney King-ish, but we really should sit down and work things out.
Active engagement, absolutely, and stop talking about supporting civil society organizations. When we talk about civil society organizations and funding them, it makes the regime think that the U.S.
Hey, Anne, we're out of time. I'm sorry.
Okay. Thank you.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
And welcome back, my friends. Sort of the situation in Washington, D.C. right now, particularly with the Tom DeLay Political Death Watch, which we will be getting to in just a moment. First, however, let's hear a report from Ellen Ratner, the Talk Radio News Service in Washington, D.C. Hey, Ellen, welcome to the program. What's up in Washington today?
Thank you. You know, one of the things they're saying about this is this trips to the Northern Mariana Islands done by Tom DeLay. Now, by the way, I've been to the Northern Mariana Islands, and I've seen those factories that the trips are for.
This is Saipan.
Right. Yeah. And they don't let the women pretty much out. We tried to get in. They wouldn't let us into the front door. It was a very interesting story.
It's slave labor.
That's exactly what it is. If you go to the... in fact, I was asked by a conservative at one point to go to this Mariana trip, and I turned it down, and when I was in Guam, flew to the Marianas and went myself. But now they had some staff trips paid for also. Two delay aides had, according to AP, had travel expenses paid for by Abramoff. But I will tell you, there is an interesting story brewing about delay, where some of his staffers' wives may have had some corporations and some money coming into that. That's just sort of brewing, and it isn't cognizant yet, but be on the lookout for that.
So he's been spreading it around.
And you heard it here first, because we got that from some pretty interesting sources.
Great. Right here on the Tom Hartmann radio program, the Talk Radio News Service's Ellen Ratner breaks a story.
Well, we're just looking into it. I'm not going to go 100% with it, but I'm saying, you know, remember when you used to play hot potato or whatever? You're getting hot, you're getting hot. Well, that's getting hot.
Yeah. Great. That's great. What else is going on?
Steny Hoyer today had a, you know, he had his pen and pencil. He rejected Bush's call for progressive indexing.
Let our callers know who Steny Hoyer is.
Oh, he's a minority whip. I'm sorry.
Yeah, he's the kind of the number two Democrat in the House of Representatives.
Right, and he said anyone making $55,000 or more would actually be better off if Congress did nothing. And he said that Democrats believe that they have a time to craft a bipartisan plan. So
this with regard to Social Security.
That's right.
Yeah.
And now, you know how I've been talking about the fact that I believe, and I have some basis for this belief, that there's really more than 140,000 troops in Iraq.
Yes, you suggested there may be as many as 200,000 U.S. troops
in Iraq.
That's
right, 210 is the
210.
Figure I heard.
Mm-hmm.
Well, of course, now front page of the New York Times is classified report submitted to Congress by General Myers, who's the Joint Chiefs of Staff chair, before Peter Pace takes over, and that's another long story that I can tell you. But they say that we're not really ready. We have strained our manpower and resources. Well, at 140,000, we probably haven't. But if you got more to the realistic number of 210, we probably have.
And this after Bush in his news conference, when he was asked, have we strained the military, he said, well, you'll have to ask General Myers. So I guess General Myers says, yes, Bush, you screwed it up!
Right. Exactly.
Incredible.
So that's interesting. Now, there's one other. There's a very forward, well, I wouldn't say forward. I'd say she wants to be forward, new member of Congress. She's a freshman from North Carolina. And let me just, her name is escaping me the second. But in any case, she has started a RoboCop bill, she's calling it, to stop those robot phone calls that you get before an election, and issue-oriented ones, so that people would put themselves essentially on a political no-call list, and you would not get those robocalls. She's put in a bill for that. I don't know if it's going to get anywhere or not. My guess is it won't, but she's trying to make a name for herself, and in places like New Hampshire, the swing states, people can get up to, 20 calls a week that way.
Yeah, well, that's a great idea. The no-call list bill that was passed into law a couple of years ago had a huge exemption for politicians and for nonprofits.
That's
so
right.
This would plug that loophole. Well done. Ellen Ratner with the Talk Radio News Service. Ellen, thanks so much for being with
You're
us today.
You're welcome.
Do appreciate it. Always wonderful to hear from you. It's 29 minutes past the hour. I'm Tom Hartmann.
This is the Democracy Zone with Tom Hartmann.
And who's gonna pay the bill? Gonna pay the bill. Not Rush Limbaugh, not George Will, not those chicken hawks on Capitol
Hill.
Not a chance.
Not
the tax cut billionaires. You know the drill.
Hey, up all of George W. Bush's debt, trying to make the economy look good, trying to make it look like his conservative economics borrow and spend policies have some juice to them, some vitality, some life, some credibility, some reasonableness. They're insane. They are nuts. It's just, it's over the top to think that borrowing money from our children and grandchildren and spending it today in large part by giving it in the form of so-called tax cuts to millionaires and billionaires is rational economics. It's not rational economics. It's theft. It's theft, pure and simple. 1-866-889-8894, telephone number, Xavier in Santa Cruz, California on the line. Hey, Xavier.
Good morning, Tom.
What's up?
2 points I wanted to make, or actually a point and a question. First thing, you were talking about Jimmy Carter. I agree with you. He's a great guy, and still is. The Vietnam War, I think that history is repeating itself, and I really believe that, you know, as I tried to find a silver lining in this 8 years of Bush, and I think it is that's going to push us to get a really wonderful president next time around.
It's who's really waking up America, I
but
can
I'm
tell
concerned
you.
That he's going to have an insurmountable problem with the debt that's been run up for this war. And I see that as a repeating of this.
Yeah, well, it's not just the war. I mean, the war has only cost $300 or $400 billion. The tax cuts for the wealthy have cost us trillions of dollars, thousands of billions of dollars. And George Bush's plan and the plan of the cons and the neocons, and Grover Norquist has been unabashed in laying this out. I mean, they'll just tell you right up front. Their plan is to, they call it starve the beast. It was a phrase that was coined during the Reagan administration. It's to run the country, run our government so badly in debt that we won't be able to spend any more money. It's like encouraging, it's like encouraging your child. If you had a teenager or somebody, you know, a child who had just gone out and was living on his or her own and saying, well, why don't you buy a new house? Why don't you buy new furniture? Why don't you buy a new TV? Why don't you buy a new car? And then when they are totally in debt up to their eyeballs and they can't even pay their credit card bills anymore, they're having to eat dog food, then you stand around and say, well, see, I told you so. You shouldn't have all that stuff.
Yeah.
And it's, I mean, this is their strategy, and they're really believing that they are so hobbling this country that those horrible socialist programs that the Republicans hate, like Social Security and Medicare, will have to go away regardless of who's president, because they will have thrown the country into such deep debt that we're going to have to dramatically raise taxes just to take us back to where we were the last year of the Clinton administration.
The main point I wanted to make was on a different subject about your guest, the segment before the last.
Ann Miller?
Was that her name? Yeah.
Yeah, from who had visited Iran, yes.
Yeah, I thought that was really great when she was talking about people wanting to email, you know, stay in contact. This is something when I went to China, I wanted to set up something. And I wanted to find out from her, I don't know if there's any way to get a message to her, or contacting people in Iraq, and not just Iraq, but other
countries. You mean Iran. She was in Iran. Yeah.
That's right. You're right. I remember that now. Iran, yeah. Is there any way to, I'd like to talk to people in Iran and other countries as well. Is there anything that could be set up to, you know, communicate with people via email?
That's a good question. I honestly don't know. I would guess that a Google search might find that for you. You might want to drop into our chat room. There's a couple of real Google experts there who are really good at tracking things down like that. And if not, call back after the top of the hour and ask Louise when she answers the phone. She can give you the information on how to get in touch with Ann. Maybe Ann can help you out with that.
All righty.
Okay. Xavier, thanks a lot for the call. Great to hear from you.
Yeah.
1-866-889-8894, telephone number, Amy in San Diego on the line. Hey, Amy, welcome to the Tom Hartman program. Thanks for calling.
Hi, Tom. I wanted to ask you a question. You've been saying that the top 1% is actually just 7,000 people?
No, not the top 1%.
Oh, I'm sorry.
There are 7,000 families in America with an income of greater than $10 million a year.
Income of $10 million?
$10 million a year.
A year or greater. Okay, that's what I wanted to know. I wanted to know what that 7,000 figure was.
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay.
7,000 families with an income of greater than $10 million a year. And they're the families. This is the bunch that, by and large, is piping the pipe, you know, singing the tune. I mean, Cheney was part of that for a while when he was head of Halliburton.
Right.
I'm not sure that any of the Bushes have ever dropped right into that category. Probably George W. or George Herbert Walker Bush, when he was running Carlyle Group, was making that kind of money.
Yeah.
And these are the folks who are singing the tune to which the United States government is dancing.
Absolutely. This is just amazing. So I wanted to stop using, you know, the percentage and start saying the actual number. I think it really puts it more into perspective for people.
Yeah.
Yeah. Great. Well, thank you so much, Tom.
You're welcome, Amy. Thanks for the call.
Okay, bye.
Good to hear from you. And pleased to provide the clarification. The Tom DeLay Death Watch alert continues. Yes. Now the political death watch, we should say. The majority of voters in Texas, in his own district, his own voters in his own district, the majority of them disapprove of the job Tom DeLay is doing as a member of Congress. 51% disapproved. This in one of the most Republican districts in the whole entire United States. People who are willing to overlook corruption, people who are willing to overlook the fact that their air has been polluted by toxic industries, that their water has been polluted by toxic industries, all so that it can help out the Republicans financially. These people, 51% of them say, enough already. 22% give him an F on the report card, A through F, as a congressman. 16% give him a D, 18% give him a C. The total of those, 357%. Here's a question. This is clearly not a push poll. This is just straight up. Survey USA did this poll. Here's the question. See, very often you don't know what the question is, and so you hear the numbers and you go, "Wow, wow!" You know, it's a no. Here, I will share with you the question based on what you know right now. Do you think Tom DeLay should remain in his position as House Majority Leader? A. He should resign as House Majority Leader but remain a member of Congress, B. Or do you think he should completely resign from Congress, C. 36% of the people in his district said he should completely resign from Congress. Right now, leave town, Tom DeLay. Take your inhaler of bug killer with you. You can sit down there and sniff that stuff all day long and hallucinate all the left-wing conspiracies you want. You brought yourself down. 36% resigned from Congress. 21% additionally say, this is a total of 61%. No, 36 and 21 is, oh, there's 4% who are not sure. If you add the not sures to the resign from Congress and the resign from leadership, you end up with 61% say, DeLay, get out of the way. Get out of the way. Democrats say the local poll showed DeLay is vulnerable at the ballot box. Interesting. Tom DeLay is up for re-election in 2006. To my listeners in Houston, in Sugarland, in Tom DeLay's district, let me recommend, get active. Get out there. Start doing stuff. Join the Democratic Party. Join the Republican Party, for that matter. Get out there and get active. This is a race that somebody needs to be paying some serious attention to. 1-866-889-8894, our phone number, Florian in Arlington Heights, Illinois, on the line. Hey, Florian.
Yeah, hi, Tom. Hey, Tom, a question. I've been reading, the Iraq thing, and these multitude of suicide bombers. Has anybody ever determined who these people are? The Sunnis are thought to be secular people that are just worried about losing their country. They're not necessarily interested in killing themselves.
Well, it's a common misperception, Florian, about the Sunnis. Let me just point out that Saudi Arabia is Sunni, that Osama bin Laden is a Sunni. So the Sunnis who were running Iraq under Saddam Hussein, by and large, were cronies and buddies of Saddam's, and up until the last year when all of a sudden Saddam got religion, they were secularists, and he had a secular nation. He did not allow the Sunnis, or the Shiites for that matter, to impose religion on the people. But there are fundamentalists within the Sunni world, and there are fundamentalists within the Shia world. The fundamentalists in the Shia world tend to take the form of the mullahs, you know, in Khomeini and Khomeini in Iran and like that. I mean, sort of the operational center of the Shia world is really Iran, although many of its holiest sites are in southern Iraq, and there's a huge Shia population in southern Iraq. And I believe that Syria is Shia also. I may be wrong on that. And there's some Shias in Lebanon, and there's one other country, and I don't remember which one it is. Most of the rest of the Arab world in the Middle East, and most of the rest of the Arab world around the world, in Indonesia, for example, in Malaysia, you know, in Africa, where Islam is spreading so rapidly, most of them are Sunnis. And these two splits have to do with One of them, and I forget, I always mix up which one is which, and I suspect probably most people do. It's one of those things kind of hard to keep track of. But one of these two groups is the lineal descendant of Muhammad's nephew or Muhammad's grandson or whatever. They claim the lineage of Muhammad. And the other group, see, when Muhammad died, it wasn't actually his descendants who took over Islam initially. It was his student, his number two guy. And the other group claims the lineage from the number two guy. And as I said, I'm not sure which is which. I think the Shia are the ones who claim to be the descendants of Muhammad, and the Sunnis are the descendants of the number two guy. Sort of like in Christianity. Modern Christianity is not from the lineage of the followers of Jesus. It's from the followers of Paul. The followers of Jesus formed a church called the Jerusalem Church, and that was, you know, Peter and all those guys that were close to him that you read about in the Bible. And that church died out within 150 to 200 years, whereas Paul's church, Paul had never met Jesus when he was alive, Paul's church took over and became Christianity. So there was that big schism back there 2,000 years ago. Same thing happened in Islam. And so you got the Sunnis and the Shias, and there's extremists in both bunch.
Yeah. Well, that would infer then the Sunnis are just as apt to be suicide bombers as the Shiites or anyone else.
Well, as far as I can tell, even far more so. I don't know, and I may be wrong on this, and if I am, I hope somebody will call and correct me, but I don't know of any Shia suicide bombings that have happened. To the best of my knowledge, for example, most of the Muslims in Israel and Palestine and that area, they're Sunnis, as I recall. And I think it's out of Sunni Islam. It's out of Wahhabism, which is a sect within Sunniism. It's like in Protestantism and Christianity, for example, you've got all these sects. You've got the Methodists and you've got the Lutherans and you've got, you know, the Church of God and this and that and the other thing. And one of these sects within the Sunni faith is the Wahhabists, which was started in the last century by a guy named Wahha. Who the Saudis brought to power and gave him a lot of money and said basically, you know, they cut a deal with the devil. They said, we'll give you the religious power in this country if you'll give us the political power and access to the oil. And the Wahhabists made this deal with the Saudi royal family and helped ensure stability in Saudi Arabia. The problem is that while they were doing it, they were doing the same thing the extremist Christians are doing in the United States. They were aggressively exporting their view of the world, which included violence, which included, you know, retribution, and in the case of the Wahhabists, includes suicide bombing. And so as far as I know, and I may be wrong, but as far as I know, most all of the suicide bombers have been Sunnis.
Yeah, and it's all been directed against the Shiites, as far as I can see. Anyway.
Occasionally, yeah, and against non-Muslims, against us, for example, and against certainly against Israel. Yeah, Florian, thanks a lot for the call,
and I
hope I've added to the contributed to the conversation rather than confusing it. I'm pretty sure that that information is right, but I am, you know, I can talk with considerable confidence about the founders of America and the United States Constitution, American history, and American politics. When we get into the politics and the history of Islam, I don't claim infallibility or great vast knowledge there. We should probably get somebody on who's an expert on this stuff to explain it to us. Tom in Minnesota on the line. Tom, welcome to the program.
Hey, Tom. Yeah, I just wanted to remind everyone and remind you in 5 days, May 8th, Sunday, is the 60th anniversary of Germany's surrender ending World War II. And already talking to my German father-in-law, they're already starting celebrations over there. And I think before the Republicans...
Celebrations.
Say what?
Celebrations.
Well, yeah, they've got democracy now, right?
Ah, yeah. Okay.
And before the Republicans try to hijack these celebrations and distort history, I think we need to remind Americans of their history and that it was the Democrats and Franklin Roosevelt that led the way in defeating right-wing fascism and corporatism and saved democracy, because the Republicans are going to try to hijack this and say we Americans and wrap themselves around the flag when it was they that used to always say the Democratic Wars and they wanted to...
Oh, not only that, Rex Stout, the guy who wrote all the Nero Wolfe novels, published this book called The Illustrious Dunderheads, which
uh-huh.
is now an incredible collector's item. It's hundreds of dollars to get a copy of it,
uh-huh.
in which he compiled all the speeches on the floor of the House and Senate by the Republicans in the late 1930s and early 1940s in support of Hitler and arguing that we should not enter World War II. And it's an entire book. It's an entire book. I mean, it's hundreds of speeches, all by Republicans on the floor of the House and the floor of the Senate, saying that we should not allow Roosevelt to get us into World War II.
Exactly.
It's called The Illustrious Dunderheads by Rex Stout. It should be back in print.
But you can't get it. You said it.
Well, you can find it in the antique bookstores, you know, if you want to spend $300 on a book.
Right.
AEBooks.com, that kind of thing.
Okay. Yeah, what's interesting is, again, the liberals are not talking about it, and you know, Germany and Japan are successful democracies because of the liberals. They set up a parliamentary system, you know, to get true representation. They set up democracy in the workplace with, you know, and we have to remind Americans it was the Democrats who did this.
Amen. Amen.
Yeah.
Well said, Tom. Thanks a lot. May 8th, the anniversary of the surrender of Hitler.
Right-wing fascism.
Of right-wing. There you go. Thank you for the reminder.
Yeah.
The surrender of right-wing fascism in Germany. The end of the Republicans. The beginning of the Democrats. 10 minutes before the hour.
Fearlessly exploring the truth of the day, here's Tom Hartman.
Tell me, George, if there's any damn way that there'll ever be a day I can get on a plane.
Well, George,
without worrying about the next maniac trying to pay me back just 'cause you're half insane.
Oh, my.
Right-wing freak judges, $200 billion grudges. Yes, war's cooked up right from day one. Big corporations are running this nation like it never was meant to be run.
Oh, I hope you're having fun,
yes,
George.
Yes, George, I hope you're having fun.
And apparently he is, and he's got now Laura out there fronting for him, although the line about milking a male horse didn't seem to go over all that well with everybody. Robert in Washington, D.C. has an answer to some of my questions about Islam. Hey, Robert.
Hey, Tom. How you doing?
I'm great, but I'll get better. What's up?
It is the Shiites that believe that... The line should be from Muhammad's son-in-law, Ali, who is married to his daughter, Fatima.
Okay, great. So the Shiites are the ones who are claiming the direct blood lineage, as it were, more or less.
Right.
And the Sunnis are the ones who are claiming the lineage from the Muhammad's right-hand man, whose name escapes me. You probably know it.
Actually, I don't know that guy's name, but yeah, that's right.
Okay. So that's so I had it right.
Yep.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Well, that's good to know. That's good to know. Do you know anything about Shiite suicide bombers?
No, I don't.
Okay. So that's another question that's still up in the air. Perhaps somebody in our chat room will figure it out. Robert, thanks a lot for the call.
Okay.
I appreciate it. Thanks for verifying that in my best guess I was right. Nathan in Grand Rapids on the line. Hey, Nathan.
Yes. Hey, how you doing?
I'm great. What's up?
Hey, just listen to your program for a little while. My dad kind of turned me on to you. And just got a question. I was wondering if there's a possibility of anybody putting something together like an impeachment proposal just off the sheer...
It's already been done. Ramsey Clark, the former Attorney General of the United States under Jimmy Carter, has put together a formal bill of impeachment. And he got, I believe, a Democrat, I'm not sure who, actually introduced it in the House, but it's not going anywhere. You have to have a majority of the House to impeach a president, and then you have to have a majority of the Senate to have the trial, so it's not going to happen. It's a great idea.
Yeah, just thought I'd ask.
Yeah, it's a great idea, and as I said, Ramsey Clark has done it, and if you just Google Ramsey Clark impeach Bush, you will find all the details on it. It's right there. Nathan, thanks a lot for the call. Great to hear from you. It's the Tom Hartman Radio Program. Where our talking points come from Jefferson and Madison, not some right-wing think tank or the RNC or the memo of the day from Faux News.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information. uncovers corporate lies, exposes political corruption, and has a clear vision of what America could become. Here's Tom Hartman.
And welcome back, my friends, to the real free speech zone. Tom Hartman here with you, defending America from the conservative weapons of mass deception. Louise just printed out for me a photo of a billboard on display in Texas, in Tom DeLay's district. Here's this marvelous billboard. It says, "Lobbyists sent Tom DeLay golfing. All you got was this billboard." I love it. It's great. Thank you so much. And wherever you found it, however you got it, that is absolutely great. In this recovery, corporations win, workers lose. Christian Science Monitor notes today, they looked at data going all the way back to 1929. So we're looking, you know, including the Great Depression, the period of the Great Depression, all the way back to 1929, they looked at data. And this economists on the Center on Budget and Policy Priorities in Washington, D.C., what they found was that while just recently, for example, since last May, when the economy began creating jobs again, keep in mind, essentially ever since George Bush became president, no, it wasn't 9/11, and no, it wasn't the bursting of the so-called stock market bubble. What it was George Bush came into town and said, okay, we're going to do conservative economic policies. And everybody in Wall Street said, well, we know what that does. That runs up a huge debt and that drives the country into a, you know, it's a train wreck. And so they bailed out of the market. It doesn't take a rocket scientist to do this. I mean, this is an open secret on Wall Street. This is an open secret among investors. You go back and look at the last 150 years of American history, and every time there's been a Democratic president, literally, go chart it. Google it. There's no shortage of these graphs out there on the web. Every time there's been a Democratic president, the stock market has gone up and the economy has gotten stronger. Every time there's been a Republican president, the stock market has gone down and the economy has gotten weaker. Without exception. And so Bush gets elected. Investors go, well, time to move to bonds. Time to get out of the stock market. So anyhow, in May of this last year, some 11 months ago, for the first time since Bush became president, we actually started creating jobs. Now, they weren't exactly the kind of jobs that we all would want. Those jobs are in India or China, but there were jobs. However, the average hourly earnings of non-farm production workers have fallen by 0.7% after adjusting for inflation. Fallen. In 1983, the year of the last major reform of the Social Security system, let me get back to this here, to investors. This, as wages are falling, by contrast, corporate profits' share of national income last year was 11.4%, exceptionally high, according to the study. By the way, the last year that it was exceptionally high, 1929. A bad sign, my friends. In 1983, the year of the last major reform of the system, this being the Social Security system, payroll taxes were imposed on 90% of all earnings. Okay, so this was during Reagan, the second year of the Reagan administration, when the Greenspan and Moynihan Commission got together and said, okay, what are we going to do about Social Security? The baby boomers are going to start retiring in 20 years. We have to do something now. And so they moved back the retirement age from, as I recall, 65 to 67, something like that, and they raised Social Security taxes. And this was a bipartisan effort. Ronald Reagan raised a lot of taxes. He had a huge tax cut when he first came into office that everybody loves to talk about. And then for six consecutive years, the last 6 years of his administration, every single year he raised taxes. He had to. George Herbert Walker Bush had to raise taxes. Even though he campaigned on a Read My Lips, No New Taxes pledge, he had to raise taxes. Why? Because Reagan's first year in office, first 2 years in office, he was pursuing the same policies that Junior is pursuing right now. George Bush, by the way, I've recently discovered the one way to really get under his skin is to call him Junior. He hates to be called Junior, so that's his new official name for me. The policies that Junior is following, Bush Junior is following right now, are the policies that Reagan started out with. We hadn't seen them since the Hoover administration. They came back around, yeah, let's do this, let's cut taxes on the very wealthy, throw the government into deficit, borrow money from our children and grandchildren, spend that money on the military and on big boondoggle projects, and help out the wealthiest among us, and screw the middle class. Reagan tried it for 2 years, and then calmer heads prevailed. I mean, the reality is that Reagan, by the second, third year there, was already starting to go fairly seriously senile. And so they could just come along and say, okay, you know, we will claim that you were the great tax cutter. But it didn't work. You know, they all point back at Jack Kennedy. They say, you know, the taxes, when Hoover had and we had this huge collapse in 1929, the Great Depression, the tax rates, income tax rates were very, very low. I don't have the numbers in front of me, but my recollection is they were in the 20% range. Franklin Roosevelt raised the top tax, the tax on people who make millions and billions, on the 7,000 families in America who earn over $10 million a year. He raised that top tax to 90%. 90%. And he did it fairly early on in the 1930s. 33, as I recall. 33, 34, something like that. Fairly early on. And it stayed there. Stayed there right up. It stayed there through Truman. It stayed there through Eisenhower. And when John Kennedy came into office, being from a very wealthy family himself, he understood how these things work. And he gave a speech, and I, you know, you've heard the clips of it on this program before. I won't play it again. But he gave a speech in which he said, the very wealthiest among us, people like the Kennedy family, they're not paying that 90% tax. Because over the years, ever since Roosevelt paid that tax, and particularly after Eisenhower became president, well, actually, particularly when Truman was president, this is when it really started, in 47. The election of 46 was the year that the Republicans seized control of the House and Senate. And starting in 46, they started punching loopholes in that tax code so that the very wealthy Republicans didn't have to pay that 90% tax. And by the time John Kennedy came into office, after the Republican control of the House and Senate during Truman's years and during Eisenhower's years, Eisenhower's 8 years, and you had Truman for 4 years, during all that time, when John Kennedy came into office, he said, hey, this tax code is like Swiss cheese. Nobody's paying 90%. No, most of these people aren't even paying 50%. A lot of them aren't even paying 30%. There's so many loopholes in this tax code that some of these people aren't paying anything at all. So let's close up the loopholes and start generating some revenue for this government, because we've got things to do. We want to put a man on the moon. We've got a defense to build. We want to strengthen our nation's schools. We want to educate our young people. We want to have a national program for gifted kids on the one hand and for learning disabled kids on the other. We want to strengthen our schools. We want to improve on and build the Eisenhower highway system. We want to have a national rail system. I mean, all these things. It's going to take some money. So the way that we're going to do it is we're going to close all those loopholes so everybody has to pay their taxes again. And as a tip of the hat to the rich people, to those 7,000 families who earn more than $10 million a year, I don't know how many it was back then, and of course everything is inflation-adjusted dollars. So, but in any case, he said, in a tip of the hat to the rich people, we're going to lower the top tax rate from 90% to 70%. But they're actually going to have to start paying 70%. And boy, did they howl. The Republicans hated this. The Republicans fought at tooth and nail Kennedy's tax reforms. But he got them through Congress. He was a very charismatic guy. He had a lot of political power. He got them through Congress. And guess what? Revenues actually went up. And ever since then, the cons have been saying, well, Kennedy lowered income tax rates and it increased government revenue. So it must be that whenever you lower taxes, you increase revenue. Come on. How about a little reality here? You're not going to get that on right-wing talk radio. You're not going to get that from the cons in the Republican Party or the few cons. There's a few cons in the Democratic Party as well. They're running around going, oh, yes, lower taxes on the rich. By the way, most of them happen to be the rich or in the employ of the rich. And usually the very good, very well employed by the rich. So here we have this train wreck that George W. Bush brought about, this absolute economic train wreck. Corporate profits up 11%, average hourly earnings for non-farm production workers down 0.7%. And then we go back to Social Security. This is where I started this rant. In 83, this was the last time that the system got reformed. Payroll taxes were paid by 90% of, 90% of all people who paid taxes were paying payroll taxes. Or let me rephrase that so it's absolutely accurate. This from the Christian Science Monitor. In 1983, payroll taxes were imposed on 90% of all earnings. Over the last 4 years, the cap has covered only an average of 85% earnings. That's because the cap, $90,000 this year, has not increased sufficiently to make up for the more rapid growth in income of prosperous Americans. In other words, there's more people getting incredibly rich, and of course, they don't have to pay any income tax on any income over $90,000. And the people in the middle who are making less than $90,000 are making a lot less than $90,000 than they used to. People who are making 30 are now making 25. The people who are making 50 are now making 45. That sort of thing. Average wages are actually going down. More people are unemployed. And so now the payroll tax, the Social Security tax, is only being slapped onto 85% of earnings. Raising the cap again so that it covers 90% of earnings would cover 40% of the gap in the 75-year planning used by the Social Security Administration. 40%. You want another 20%? Simply use more realistic assumptions on productivity and economic growth for the coming years. Another 20%. Wages and salaries got only 23% of real income growth in this recovery, compared with 49% for the same years and months in previous recoveries. Why? Because Bushonomics, voodoo economics, phony economics, Republican, conservative, insane economic policies. Corporate profits, however, the numbers are 44% this time and 18% in previous recoveries. This is from David R. Francis in the Christian Science Monitor. So, let's see. Corporate profits up. Average wages down. Sounds like Bush to me. 20 minutes past the hour.
Bringing democracy to the United States of America, here's Tom Hartman.
And welcome back to the True People's Radio, news without conflicts of global corporate interest. Tom Hartman here with you. Yes, never frittering or wasting here. Uncommon sense from the radical middle. This just in, news flash from CNN, the runaway bride, this by the way from Moondog in our chat room, thanks Moondog, the runaway bride has run away again, but this time she's taken Michael Jackson with her. Fox News has paid bounty hunters to find them fast, otherwise they will have to report real news. That just in from your eagle eye folks in the chat room, thanks. Moondog, thanks so much for that. 1-866-889-8894, our telephone number. Mike in Washington, D.C. on the line. Hey, Mike, welcome to the program.
Hey, Tom. How are you this afternoon?
Great. What's up?
I hate to do this, but I have to pick at you.
Good.
A couple of things. And please don't don't forget, I'm on your side.
Okay.
So I'm a little bit...
In other words, don't yell at you and hang up on. Now, that only happens right. on right-wing talk shows.
Right. I'm a little bit further to the left than you are.
Okay.
Good bit further to the left, I would say. But the things I wanted to pick at you about, one, just a comment. The worst thing to have happen to you in Georgia is to be either a victim or a hero. Ask the runaway bride's husband or Richard Jewell.
Yeah. Yeah, I lived in Atlanta when when the bombing happened. Yeah, absolutely.
And Georgia went after Jewell, and they went after her fiancé.
It wasn't just Georgia who did that, though. I mean, that was national. That was the national feeding frenzy. We saw the same thing with Stephen Hatfield. I mean, what's the point there, Mike?
No, that was just a comment, that's all.
Okay.
But what I needed to pick at you about, yes, Carter is a good man. Yes, he was a good president in some ways. But let's not forget, it was Carter, through his Secretary of State, Brzezinski, or no, was he NSA? I forget.
Brzezinski was the National Security Advisor.
NSA, okay. It was Brzezinski who pushed the idea of giving the Russians their own Vietnam and Afghanistan and supplying and organizing and funding the Mujahideen, and which eventually got brought our friend Osama bin Laden to Afghanistan, and which served as the core of Al-Qaeda.
Yeah, bottom line, Mike, is that there is no shortage, and you and I can, between the two of us, probably come up with a huge long list that goes all the way back to Thomas Jefferson. There is no shortage of American policies that are done largely to further corporate interests, and the thing in Afghanistan certainly was to help UNICAL out. That's what it was all about. It was about building a pipeline. And to the extent that Carter and the Carter administration participated in that, I will condemn them. And Jimmy Carter was the last president of the United States to seriously talk about and actually try and do something about around the world things like human rights. I still think, you know, greatness is certainly flawed, but I still think that if you want to look at presidents in my lifetime, he was the last great president in our life in my lifetime. Jack Kennedy, I don't think he was around long enough to really be measured, although his behavior with the Cuban Missile Crisis and his behavior after the Bay of Pigs invasion were noble.
Right. And I agree with you. You know, like I said, Carter was a good man. He had bad policies, though, as well. However, with this regime, it's not just the case of a bad policy. The entire regime is corrupt.
Oh, the entire bunch of them. They're all corporatists. I mean, we've never seen this before. Well, we have. We saw it during the Ulysses S. Grant administration. It was the last time, I think, that we really seriously saw an entire administration devoted to simply serving one major industry. In the Grant administration, it was the railroads. Now it's the oil industry. And the politicians essentially being for sale.
Exactly. I mean, during the Grant administration, when they had people on the floor of the House and the Senate, handing out credit mobilization.
Yes, yes, among other things. Yes, absolutely. And that's why the Republican Party refused to nominate Grant for his third term, even though he wanted to run, because he was so corrupt. You know, would that the Republican Party would come to its senses with regard to Bush. But no, I think the entire party has been corrupted. Mike, thanks a lot for your call. I appreciate it. And, you know, feel free to take me to task anytime. That was pretty mild. 29 minutes past the hour.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
And welcome back, my friends. Yes, we've got to move. We've got to move this country. Got to move this country in a positive direction. Move this country towards some sort of positive reform. Let's bring back democracy to America. That, of course, means first we have to get rid of the Bushies and the DeLays and all the other corrupt, warmongering, corporatist, the Stalinists, for lack of a better word. Italy now is talking about pulling their troops out of Iraq. The Italians are seriously upset with us. The army released their report a few days ago on the killing of Nicola Calipari, the Italian equivalent of a CIA agent or a Secret Service agent. I guess it would be more like a CIA agent, an intelligence agent, who had gone to Italy to rescue the woman journalist. And the Pentagon released this thing, and they had used Adobe Acrobat to apparently to digitize the document, and they blacked out, you know, by overlaying the text with black type. What they didn't realize, whoever did it didn't realize, is that in that program, just like with Adobe Illustrator, with that program, when you black out text, you're actually creating a layer on top of a layer, and the program remembers the layers. And so all you have to do is remove the top layer, and poof, there's the stuff beneath it. And so the Italians, and this was all over the Italian newspapers yesterday and Sunday. I mean, it was just, this was a major story. That they knew the names of the Americans who killed their Secret Service agent, Calipari. That they knew the name, that they knew the details of what was going on. All this stuff at the government that our government tried to black out, they knew. Now, it was mentioned on the American media, but I didn't see a single mainstream news story that actually reprinted the document. Maybe they're afraid of being prosecuted under the Patriot Act for printing something that's classified top secret. In fact, probably that's the case. But in Italy, they had no such reluctance, and they published this thing in Italy. And the Italians, I can tell you, are really, really, really angry. I mean, they're totally flipped out. Gianfrancano Fini, the vice president of the Council and Foreign Affairs Minister of Italy, he says, well, here, let me just, I'll just read this paragraph straight. This is from Le Figaro. Manipulation of evidence, concealment of witnesses, flagrant lies. From Rome, the official American report on Nicola Calipari's death seems so far from the truth that Silvio Berlusconi's government, although one of Washington's most enthusiastic allies, refused to co-sign it this weekend. We cannot, out of respect for Nicola Calipari and our national honor, explained Gianfranco Fini, vice president of the Council and Foreign Affairs Minister. Secret agent Nicola Calipari had been sent to Baghdad March 4th to recover journalist Giuliana Singrena, hostage to Iraqi terrorists. On the road to the airport, an American patrol opened fire on the rented Toyota Corolla, killing Calipari, wounding the journalist and the driver. Le Figaro goes on to note, this affair is torturing Silvio Berlusconi, who has to inform Parliament this week. And the Northern League is already calling for an in-depth consideration of the time to bring our contingent home. Bush lied, and thousands of U.S. soldiers died or were wounded, tens of thousands died or were injured, hundreds of thousands of Iraqis died or were injured. And now Bush lied, and an Italian secret agent died, and it might bring down our relationship with Italy. But the Bush administration has never, ever said that they made a mistake. They have never, ever apologized for anything. I mean, here you have Bush. Before the war. Now we know, as a result of revelations in the Blair government, that back in 2002, Bush was already planning the war. This was before the congressional vote, before John Kerry's tortured vote to support our president so that he would have the leverage to force Saddam Hussein to allow the inspectors in. Before that, George W. Bush and Tony Blair sat down and planned this war. It was a 2002 election campaign issue for the Republicans. This was to grab a to secure a Republican majority in the Senate and hold on to the Republican majority in the House of Representatives. That's what it was all about. That's what the war in Afghanistan was all about. The Afghans were perfectly willing. In fact, they came right out and said that they were willing to give us, well, not us, they were willing to give the world to any nation other than the United States, any Muslim nation other than the United States. They were willing to give them Osama bin Laden to be held on trial and to be executed if he was convicted. You take him into the public square in downtown Jeddah, Saudi Arabia, and cut his head off. It was just fine with the Taliban. And Bush said, no, no, we're going to have a war in Afghanistan because the 2002 elections are coming. And then as the election was coming, George W. Bush, after we now know he and Tony Blair had already decided to go to war, he has a press conference, one of the five that he's had in all the years that he's been president, and he said...
You said we're headed to war in Iraq. I don't know why you say that. I hope we're not headed to war in Iraq. I'm the person who gets to decide, not you.
Liar. Well, the last part wasn't a lie, but apparently. Although the Constitution of the United States clearly says that the power to make war is not in the hands of the president. The commander-in-chief does not have the power to make war. Only Congress can declare war. Period. And yet you have George W. Bush, number one, proclaiming that he has the sole authority to declare war, and number two, saying, and this, now we know, as a result of the documents that have come out in England that are smeared all over the front pages of the British newspapers, big story on the BBC, hardly touched by the American media, you have George W. Bush.
You said we're headed to war in Iraq. I don't know why you say that. I hope we're not headed to war in Iraq. I'm the person who gets to decide, not you.
Yeah. I cringe when I hear that. I just absolutely cringe. George W. Bush talking about these...
As a condition for ending the Persian Gulf War, the Iraqi regime was required to destroy its weapons of mass destruction, to cease all development of such weapons, and to stop all support for terrorist groups.
And we knew at the time that he had done that. Scott Ritter was there saying, hey, they're gone. It's over. There is no more of this stuff. We destroyed it all. He hasn't had the ability to rebuild it. Nobody's been selling him stuff that he can be used to be. He's been building palaces and writing a novel. He actually was. Saddam Hussein was writing a novel, an epic romance. He was writing a Harlequin novel. His senior military staff were behaving like the Three Stooges, running around going, whoa, 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 bumping into each other. No weapons were being made. He produced 14,000 pages and gave them to the United Nations and said, see here, proof. All of this stuff has been destroyed. The United States grabbed hold of it and took 5,000 of those pages and redacted them, removed them, so that the rest of the UN couldn't see them. Why? Because those were the pages that pointed out that all those weapons of mass destruction that Saddam had, they were sold to him by George Bush Sr. Well, he was our ally back then. And Ronald Reagan. And it was kind of embarrassing that Don Rumsfeld would be the guy cutting the deals to sell weapons to Saddam that he then used to gas Kurds or whatever. Yeah, although there is evidence now that the Kurds were actually gassed by the Iranians in the middle of the war. They got in the way, but that's a whole other discussion. So here we have George Bush. And he says, as a condition of the war, the Iraqis were required to get rid of their weapons. And then he continues.
The Iraqi regime has violated all of those obligations. It possesses and produces chemical and biological weapons. It is seeking nuclear weapons.
Just, it is so important, I think, from time to time for us to remind ourselves what a bald-faced liar is in the White House right now. Conflating 9/11. All of the 15 of the 19 hijackers on 9/11 were Saudi citizens. They were from the country who is led by the man who was holding George Bush's hand last week, who was kissing him on the face. Actually, we should say George Bush was kissing Prince Abdullah and was holding his hand. And yet Bush tries to conflate 9/11 and Saddam Hussein. Saddam Hussein had nothing to do with 9/11. It was a Saudi operation. It was put together by, if you want to attach a country to it, it was put together by a Saudi citizen, Osama bin Laden, whose family, whose brother, by the way, Salem bin Laden, had bailed out George W. Bush's oil company, however you say it in Spanish, means shrub, Armbrusto Oil Company, back in 1979. His oil company was bailed out by Salem bin Laden, Osama's brother. And weirdly, when the news of this came out, Salem bin Laden's plane crashed and he died. But nonetheless, here's George W. Bush conflating these two, mixing together 9/11 and Saddam Hussein, just to confuse Fox News watchers.
We must also never forget the most vivid events of recent history. On September the 11th, 2001, America felt its vulnerability, even to threats that gather on the other side of the earth.
Right, and then he continues to rant about Saddam.
First, some ask why Iraq is different from other countries or regimes that also have terrible weapons. While there are many dangers in the world, the threat from Iraq stands alone.
Yeah, because it's no threat!
Because it gathers the most serious dangers of our age in one place.
We must never forget these words.
If we know Saddam Hussein has dangerous weapons today, and we do, does it make any sense for the world to wait to confront him as he grows even stronger and develops even more dangerous weapons?
This is a man who was willing to lie to his nation in order to get reelected, who saw in the year 2000, who sat down with Karl Rove and saw as the core of his campaign to run for reelection, war. The death of hundreds of thousands of people. When you add up Afghanistan and Iraq, the deaths of human beings, the deaths of people like you, and every single one of those who died wanted to live every bit as much as you or me. This is a man who saw as his re-election strategy, as his ticket to power, the death of others.
This is a massive stockpile of biological weapons and is capable of killing millions. We know that the regime has produced thousands of tons of chemical agents, including mustard gas, sarin nerve gas, VX nerve gas.
Actually, that was back when your daddy sold it to them and Don Rumsfeld brokered the deal. But see, Scott Ritter and the UNSCOM and the UN, they got rid of all that stuff. And they verified that they got rid of it. And Saddam verified that they got rid of it. And Hans Blix went over and went all over the country. He couldn't find any of it. Mohammed El-Baradei went all over the country. Couldn't find any of it. The only country in the world that you could convince of this madness was England. And that was because Tony Blair thought that he saw a political opportunity in it, because he's another craven political opportunist. Come on, George, tell us another lie.
We've also discovered through intelligence that Iraq has a growing fleet of manned and unmanned aerial vehicles that could be used to disperse chemical or biological weapons across broad areas. We're concerned that Iraq is exploring ways of using these UAVs for missions targeting the United States.
The UAVs, yes, they had a balsa wood model airplane. One. 3-foot wingspan. And with this, George W. Bush said that Saddam Hussein was going to attack America and spread biological weapons. And after the anthrax attacks by persons unknown, he genuinely succeeded in scaring people. Well, I probably loaded you down with as many Bush lies as you can handle for the day. We'll save the rest for some other time. Haley Barbour is poking around, thinking about running for president in 2008. Newsday and the New York Sun are the latest to promote him, Mississippi Governor Haley Barbour. Wouldn't this be a dream come true, says David Sirota, for the Democrats? According to Public Citizen, after Philip Morris was the top Republican donor in 1996, Haley Barbour became a tobacco lobbyist. Time magazine reports that during Barber's tenure as a tobacco lobbyist, two Republican Party officials said Barber deviously tried to slip a $50 billion tax break for tobacco companies into a budget bill. Remember Jack Abramoff this weekend saying that his job was to help his clients spend a few million to earn billions? Well, Haley Barber seems to have the same philosophy. Now, according to the Campaign for Tobacco-Free Kids, Barber has used the governor's office in Mississippi to try to gut funding for Mississippi's award-winning youth tobacco prevention program. This from the governor of the state that originally forced the tobacco companies to admit that their products caused cancer. This is from David Sirota. Haley Barber, the drug industry lobbyist. Barber was also a top lobbyist for the drug industry at the very time the industry helped kill proposals to lower drug prices. The Washington Post reported that Barber actually used his position as chairman of the Republican Party, as chairman of the party, to intervene on a bill raising the minimum wage, that is to stop the increase of the minimum wage, and demand lawmakers include a massive tax break for the pharmaceutical industry. Barber immediately then returned to his lobbying firm after his stint as head of the RNC. Yes, Haley Barber for president. Get on the bandwagon now, 10 minutes before the hour.
Fearlessly exploring the truth of the day, here's Tom Hartman.
And welcome back, my friends. And welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. I wrote a piece over the weekend about the lies in George W. Bush's press conference last Friday. Speaking of Bush lies, he was lying about the energy policies of the United States. Common Dreams put it up on their website today. Check out commondreams.org, and you may find that of some value. Bottom line, I'll give it to you in the short form. They asked Bush, what are you going to do about these high gas prices? Why do we have these high gas prices? And Bush said, well, the problem is that we haven't had an energy policy in the United States for 10 years. In other words, if you go back 10 years, guess who was president? Bill Clinton. In other words, blame it on Clinton. That was Bush's answer. Well, the fact of the matter is that Jimmy Carter declared a national energy policy in the United States and did so rather enthusiastically, rather outspokenly. As I have shared with you, I think I've shared you some audio. In fact, I'm sure I've shared some audio clips of this. He said it's a problem we won't solve in the next few years. It's likely to get progressively worse through the rest of this century. We must not be selfish or timid if we hope to have a decent world for our children and grandchildren. We simply must balance our demand for energy with our rapidly shrinking resources. By acting now, we can control our future instead of letting the future control us. This is Jimmy Carter. Carter bluntly pointed out the most important thing about these proposals is that the alternative may be a national catastrophe. Further delay can affect our strength and our power as a nation. This is just very straightforward. Jimmy Carter coming out, he called it the moral equivalent of war. Remember the time that phrase was first used? That was Jimmy Carter on April 18th, 1977. That he was declaring the moral equivalent of war. He said the oil and natural gas we rely on for 75% of our energy are running out. In spite of increased effort, domestic production has been dropping steadily at about 6% a year, Jimmy Carter said. I'm quoting Jimmy Carter. Imports have doubled in the last 5 years, said Jimmy Carter. Keep in mind, the last time that we were energy independent or had the capability of being energy independent was in the 1960s, the very early 1960s, the late 1950s. Jimmy Carter goes on to say our imports have doubled in the last 5 years. Doubled from 72 to 77. Thank you, Richard Nixon. Our nation's independence of economic and political action is becoming increasingly constrained, says Jimmy Carter. The world has not prepared for the future, says Jimmy Carter. During the 1950s, people used twice as much oil as during the 40s. During the 60s, we used twice as much as during the 50s. You get that? The oil consumption doubled from 1940 to 1950 and doubled again from 1950 to 1960. And, Jimmy Carter says, in each of those decades, more oil was consumed than in all of mankind's previous history. And now we're discovering where the byproducts of the consumption of all that oil ended up. It ended up in the atmosphere. Can you spell global warming? Carter agreed with M. King Hubbard. The scientist who in the 1950s said the United States would hit the Hubbard Peak in the 1970s, the point of peak oil production, and that the world would hit it around 2005. Actually, Hubbard, I think, originally predicted 2000, but nonetheless, here we are. We are now hitting the Hubbard Peak worldwide. We hit the Hubbard Peak in the United States in the mid-70s. There's no turning back, friends. We've got to go with alternative energy sources and do so quickly. Bush's bailout, or Bush's welfare plan for the oil industry is no plan at all. It's just another transfer of wealth from the middle class to the extremely wealthy corporations, and it must be stopped. We have to have a rational energy policy in this country, and that means we need to change Congress in the next election.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information.